Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the AARP Bulletin for June 2019. And when we, at last week, we were reading this interesting cover story about the insiders in Washington who are most influential in shaping the lives and circumstances of the elderly in this country. And we got through all the profiles of the different people, but I didn't have time to read this interesting sort of sidebar on called How to Be Heard in Washington. So I think we're going to wind up that subject by reading these tips for how to get your voice heard. This says, no high-powered lobbyist on your payroll, no wad of cash to donate to political campaigns, no inside connections. That doesn't mean you can't be heard in Washington and in the offices of your state lawmakers. Here are some strategies that we learned from the insiders themselves on how you can best get your ideas and concerns to those who matter, and some tips on what not to do. The advice, meet in person. Face-to-face visits are the most effective way to sway power brokers. Your lawmakers are home during frequent recesses. Town hall meetings and other public events are often lightly attended, so those who show up really get their say. So do check websites or call to find out schedules. Reach lawmakers' offices through the Capitol switchboard at 202-224-3121. Don't drop by a government or legislative office locally or in Washington and expect to be seen without an appointment. So, next thing that is recommended is write a letter or email. Personalized notes carry weight. Visit contactingcongress.org for a list of lawmakers' email and office addresses. Federal agencies have spaces to leave comments on their websites. The same is true for private interest groups. Do address people respectfully, even if you disagree. Direct your mail to your own members of Congress, not those from other places. Don't forget to give your name and contact information. Anonymous letters are likely to be ignored, as are angry diatribes. Volunteer. There are organizations already fighting for your concerns. AARP, for example, relies heavily on volunteers in Washington and all 50 states to push on issues including Medicare, Social Security, age discrimination, and fairness to caregivers. Do contact your AARP state office and ask what you can do to help fight for an issue you care about. Find information at aarp.org/states. Don't, however, think you need any special skills to help fight for an issue. When AARP volunteers show up en masse, those in power listen. Next, you're advised to join a group. Many of the issues you care about have citizens groups you can join. These grassroots organizations can really turn opinion in Washington. Check your library for the Washington Information Directory to find groups sorted by topic. Band together. Whether it's joining a formal group or just gathering with like-minded people, numbers have power. Don't use a group email template for sending to power brokers without personalizing it. These digital form letters carry little weight. Next, you're advised to start a petition. Some have worked, like a petition to allow some female aviators to be buried in Arlington National Cemetery. Many federal agencies, the FDA, for example, allow petitions to be submitted on their websites. There are also online sites that help. Do phrase your concern clearly, then work to connect with other groups who can give your effort the weight of numbers. Don't expect much if you sign a petition from a partisan group. These are mostly efforts to gather names to solicit for donations. You're advised to use social media. Most insiders now have social media accounts, Facebook, Twitter, and others. The National Kidney Foundation keeps a list of social media accounts for lawmakers at advocacy. That is advocacy.kidney.org/congressional-social-media-accounts. Do target Washington lawmakers and key officials by responding to postings on issues that matter to you on social media sites. Don't assume that a social media outpouring is going to change minds. Some issues have proven intractable to tweet storms. Finally, be creative. Sometimes being heard is about being in the right place at the right time. For example, you could be the one who writes the best response to a highly read news story or editorial, or carries the most powerful sign at a rally. So do show up. What those examples have in common is that you're at the event, or you're reading what those in power read. And finally, don't give up. Your voice matters, and it can be satisfying to make a difference. It may take some effort, but you can be heard. And now in the Your Money section of the AARP Bulletin, we have an article that's called The New Currency of Fraud. This is by Gary Weiss, and the subhead is, gift cards are used to finance scams and stop them in some lucky cases. When Denise McKendry entered the Kroger store in Midlothian, Virginia on February 25, the school teacher was visibly distraught. She was on her cell phone talking to a man who had identified himself as Officer Johnson from the IRS. He had explained in threatening and sometimes nasty terms that McKendry owed $5,207 in back taxes and that she'd be arrested if she did not pay it off. Fortunately, thanks to an arrangement among Google, the IRS, and her local police department, she could easily make a down payment on her debt and avoid jail. All she had to do was buy two $500 Google Play gift cards and read their code numbers to him over the phone. But as McKendry, who is in her 50s, tried to buy the cards by check, the clerk at the customer service counter got suspicious. "Do you know where these are going? How they are going to be used?" After a pause, she nodded, "Yes." "Okay, good," he replied, "because we get a lot of scams and they use these Google prepaid cards." McKendry covered her phone so Officer Johnson wouldn't hear. "Please help me," she mouthed. She and the clerk went to the store manager, Tim Day, who explained that she was being scammed and had her hang up. The effort to separate McKendry from her money was over. You may think of a gift card as the perfect birthday or graduation present for a relative who'd like to buy music or video games or clothing, but as McKendry's ordeal illustrates, gift cards have also become a popular payment mechanism among scam artists. Whether masquerading as IRS agents, tech support personnel, or the attorney for a grandchild who's supposedly in jail, criminals pressure their targets to buy gift cards for iTunes, Google Play, Best Buy, and other popular retailers, and order them to provide the code numbers or PINs on the back of the cards so they can be redeemed. It's a growing trend. Federal Trade Commission data shows that 26% of scammers asked for gift cards and reload cards in 2018 versus just 7% in 2015. They are nearly as untraceable as cash and are much more transferable, says Todd Hartman, Best Buy's chief risk and compliance officer. The good news, as awareness of gift card use in scams grows, so do the efforts to head off those scams. Part of that involves employee training. At Kroger Mid-Atlantic, for example, service desk personnel are trained to engage with customers to ensure they are not being scammed, and to refuse transactions if necessary, a spokeswoman says. Apple, Best Buy, and Target also say they train employees to be on the lookout for people who may be buying gift cards while in the midst of being defrauded. What we wanted to be able to do is have people recognize if they saw somebody in distress, Hartman says. Other measures include limits on the purchase and use of gift cards. Last year, three major retailers, Best Buy, Target, and Walmart, announced they were voluntarily implementing two such measures to reduce gift card fraud. One was to lower the maximum amount of money that people could load onto gift cards in one transaction. The other was to put new restrictions on using their gift cards to buy other cards, a practice that scammers use to hide their tracks. Last year, AARP collaborated with Best Buy and the National Association of Attorneys General to create a public service announcement, PSA, warning about gift card schemes. One of the key messages, gift cards are not used and cannot be used to pay bail, taxes, or court fines. I was just so relieved, says McKendry, about the help she received at Kroger. At that point, the tears came. I gave Tim a hug, and I thanked Tim and his team because they pretty much saved me from this scam. Back in the parking lot, sitting in her car, she got another phone call. It was Officer Johnson, and he was angry. "Don't you call me again," McKendry said, and this time, without any prompting, she hung up on him. Now, that was by Gary Weiss, who is a longtime investigative reporter, and he was formerly at Business Week and Condé Nast Portfolio. And now, here is an insider's tale on how crooks use gift cards. This was written by Doug Shadell, who writes the Outsmart Fraud column for AARP magazine. And he says, what exactly do scammers do with millions of dollars in gift cards? I found the answer in an interview with Yu Zhang, a 28-year-old Chinese national who recently received an 11-month prison sentence for his crimes. He had laundered money for a large fraud operation using an IRS-backed taxes scam like the one that nearly snagged Denise McKendry. Zhang explained that it is a two-step process. Immediately convert the gift cards supplied by victims into several lower-value cards, then sell those cards for cash on the open market. Through an interpreter, Zhang told me how he worked. As soon as a victim gave the IRS imposter the serial number and activation code for a $1,000 Target gift card, Zhang's manager would text the info to him via WeChat, a Chinese social app. Zhang then loaded the info onto the Target app on his phone, which allowed him to spend the $1,000 on anything at the chain. He'd then travel to a local Target and purchase four gift cards, like Google Play, Nintendo, or eBay, always using the self-serve checkout line. Doing this quickly made it impossible for the victim to retrieve the value on the original card, and it cut off the trail for any investigator trying to trace the route of the stolen money. When he left the store, Zhang would take a picture of the serial numbers on the smaller cards and send those photos to his manager, giving him full access to the funds. Then Zhang would discard the physical cards. From the moment the bad guys got gift card numbers from the victim, this process of making the money clean often took less than an hour. In a typical day, Zhang visited 10 to 15 Target stores and laundered $10,000 worth of cards. He was paid a commission of 2 to 5% for this work, depending on volume. On his best day, he laundered $30,000 worth, the take from what likely was a few dozen scam victims. And while he worked, Zhang's manager had other runners washing gift cards from Walmart, Best Buy, and other stores as part of the ongoing conspiracy. And what would the crooks do with the clean, lower-denomination cards? Simple. There is a huge market on the Internet for gift cards sold at a discount. For example, you can easily buy a $100 card for $90 in cash, no questions asked. It's perfectly legal. Business got so busy last year for Zhang and washers like him that Target stores in the Los Angeles area began running out of gift cards, Zhang says. So his manager sent him to Denver to continue the work and then to Minneapolis. But security officials from Target, Treasury Department investigators, and the U.S. Attorney's Office in Minnesota were on the operations trail, and Zhang was arrested after converting a $2,000 Target gift card into smaller denomination cards. Today, Zhang says he regrets his actions. "I want to apologize for what I did because there were a lot of victims," he says. And he has some advice. If someone calls you, don't buy any gift cards, no matter what the person tells you. Because if you do, you will never see your money again. And now let's switch to the June and July issue of Money Magazine. And we're going to read an article about, this article is called These Real Life Golden Girls Moved In Together in Retirement, How Four Women Took Control of Their Finances and Futures to Create a Place Where They Can Grow Old Together. In her late 50s and searching for a new retirement home for her mother, Louise Bardswich realized that living in any type of care facility would never be for her. The issues that arise from such a living situation, the lack of freedom, having to leave the comfort of your own home, and possible loneliness, among others, didn't appeal to her at all. Assisted living worked well for her mother, who liked it, but Bardswich knew it didn't fit her own lifestyle. Plus, she had more money than me, says Bardswich, 67, of Port Perry, Ontario. Even if I wanted a retirement home, I just couldn't afford it, says Bardswich, a former college dean, of her decision to turn away from more traditional senior housing. The national median cost of care in an assisted living facility is around $4,000 a month in the U.S., while a private room in a nursing home is $8,365, according to Genworth Financial, and the price tag is only going up. Living in a care facility in Ontario is cheaper than it is in the U.S., but it is still by no means a bargain. Instead, Bardswich embraced an unconventional housing arrangement in her later years. I recognized that at some stage I was going to be living with other people, probably because I would become infirm enough that my family said, we've got to move you in with somebody else. Bardswich didn't want to wait until that scenario was upon her. If you recognize it's going to happen anyhow, then take control, figure it out, and live with people you want to live with, she says. That take-charge attitude prompted the purchase and renovation of the home she now owns with three other retirees, Martha Casson, 70, Sandy McCulley, 74, and Beverly Brown, 67. Before they moved in together, the women knew each other socially. Bardswich and Brown were in the same curling club. They've become known as the Golden Girls of Port Perry, after the popular 80s TV series in which four older women share a home. With the help of a local builder who specializes in designing homes for seniors, they built their own version of a retirement paradise. They designed the property, a six-bedroom, wheelchair-accessible, 5,000-square-foot farmhouse, to enable them to remain independent and still enjoy the benefits of companionship and the security of knowing they can stay there forever, barring any unexpected changes to their lifestyle or health status. They moved in together in November 2016. The Golden Girls are hardly alone in wanting to lower their housing costs and enjoy a dignified retirement. The number of older adults in search of roommates is growing fast. More and more people see the benefits of shared housing. Those age 50 and over represent the fastest-growing demographic on spare room, an apartment-sharing service that helps roommates find each other via online ads and in-person meetups. The number of users age 50 and above on the site has grown 27% in the past year alone, says Matt Hutchinson, communications director for the company. Women are also more likely than men to share their homes, in part because they tend to make less money and can also end up in worse shape financially after a divorce, according to Anne Glass, a professor and gerontology program coordinator at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. While it's still only a small percentage of older people, the numbers are unprecedented and rising, she says. Many factors contribute to needing a roommate later in life, like divorce or a lack of children or other support system. But the most common reason older people bunk together is financial. Yet cohabiting out of financial necessity turned out to be one of the best things that happened to Bardswich and her new housemates in retirement. What surprised me is that I like it and it works, she says. I was really just going into it as a pragmatic solution. In that very first week, I found myself waking up in the morning and hearing voices downstairs and thinking, this is pretty cool. I wonder what they're talking about. And I'd go downstairs and coffee was ready. But living with other people can be hard if you've been living alone for a few decades. The solution for Bardswich and her three housemates was to hire lawyers to create two legal documents, one for the joint purchase of the home, the technical real estate term is tenants in common, and a legal operating agreement outlining the boundaries for day-to-day communal living in their new abode. The operating agreement addresses issues like what happens if someone needs to sell her share of the house or her estate needs to sell. It also includes an approval process for new roommates. Everyone has to agree, and if no agreement is reached after 1 year, they put the house up for sale. To avoid clashes when it comes to style and taste, the women hired an interior designer to decorate the common spaces. The operating agreement also tackles other delicate but equally important issues regarding aging in place together. As you get older, personalities can change. If something gets truly ugly, we have a process for voting someone off the island, Bardswich says. Sharing finances requires lots of planning. Trickiest of all when it comes to home sharing may be having to combine resources. For Louise, Martha, Sandy, and Bev, purchasing the Port Perry property was just the beginning of pooling their money. The initial financial commitment for each was $252,800 Canadian dollars, which is about $189,000 U.S. to buy and renovate the home and for any individual upgrades to their bedrooms and bathrooms. They also each put $20,000, this and all future dollar references are in Canadian dollars, in a joint account for things like upgrading the kitchen, new common area furniture, and extra lighting. With guidance from the Toronto Rehabilitation Institute, they outfitted the home for aging in place. They installed an elevator that goes to all three floors, roll-in showers, extra-wide doorways, stair treads, and a full caregiver suite should anyone ever require live-in help. The women don't plan to be one another's caretakers. Certainly, if somebody's sick, we'll bring them a cup of tea, but if you need real care, no, pay for it. And if you can't, or if you need more care than can be provided in the house, then it's time to go, Bardswich explains. But the women have talked about being able to share a live-in caretaker, or at least someone who does most of their cooking and housekeeping if they need help. After the upfront investment, they worked out the details of the daily operating cost of their retirement home. All four women contribute $1,100 a month to a joint account for expenses like utilities, taxes, maintenance, yard work, and the cleaning service that comes once a week. They wanted to avoid disagreements about frequency and quality of cleaning among themselves. Right now, they're each putting in an additional $200 a month to build up a $30,000 contingency fund should the house require a major repair like a new roof, Bardswich says. Streamlining their grocery shopping process also helps, she says, and they now each contribute $100 a week for food while alternating who does the shopping every week. All the food is shared. The rule is you never get to say, that's my yogurt. If it's in the fridge or in the cupboard, you can take it, Bardswich says. Built-in companionship has benefits. The women don't aim to be best friends. Bardswich thinks the arrangement has been healthy that way, but she says they often have dinner and one or two glasses of wine together. Maintaining open and direct communication is also a part of their agreement, and so far it has worked well. They discuss everything in advance to avoid potential conflict in the moment, and they generally share the same values. One in three Americans over the age of 45 admits to being lonely, according to AARP. And social isolation can lead to a higher risk of hospitalization and early death. We now know that social isolation is as bad for you as smoking cigarettes, says UNCW's Glass. So living with companions can actually be good for your health. Plus, there is the security of having someone know if something happens to you, Glass adds. Overnight guests and visits from family are allowed, along with Bev's bridge club gatherings or hosting the occasional political reception or social get-together, spontaneous porch parties included, all of which provide a sense of community in their home. Bardswich says the women also get to share grandchildren with one another. My grandsons are there all the time and talk about how it's almost like having four grandmas, she says. Sandy bakes with them, Martha gardens with them. The same thing happens with Bev's grandkids when they come over. Now, here's a little sidebar. on the don'ts of the roommate search. It says, don't invite a prospective roommate into your home. Choose a public space or video chat for your first meeting. Don't pay anything without signing a lease agreement first. And don't accept an emailed scan of an ID. Insist on seeing the actual ID in the presence of the person to whom it belongs. Now, we've only got a couple of minutes left, and so we're going to go back to the AARP bulletin for a couple of short things from their news page. One is, healthy now, but outlook is risky. Medicare and Social Security fixes urged. The trustees for Medicare and Social Security have issued their annual reports on the program's financial health, and the news is mixed. Both programs are in good shape now, and some forecasts for future prospects improve slightly, but another year is gone by without action to remedy projected shortfalls. The reports warn Congress that it must act soon to address the challenges. Without changes, Medicare's Hospital Insurance Trust Fund will begin to fall short in 2026, when it would be able to cover 89% of the program's cost. Social Security's trust funds would begin to be depleted in 2035, when they would be able to pay 80% of scheduled benefits. That's 1 year later than the 2018 report projected. The trustees also reported that in 2020, the total cost of Social Security will outstrip its annual income, meaning the program will have to begin to tap trust fund dollars. The reports show that both programs remain strong, AARP Chief Executive Officer Joanne Jenkins said, but there are long-term challenges to address on a bipartisan basis. The Medicare trustees estimated that spending will increase from 3.7% of the nation's gross domestic product in 2018 to 5.9% by 2038, and stated that there needs to be timely and effective action to address Medicare's remaining financial challenges. And lastly, veggies bought with Medicare. What if beneficiaries of Medicare and Medicaid could use a debit card to buy fresh vegetables and fruits? About 1.93 million cases of heart disease might be prevented over the lifetimes of those now enrolled in the programs, researchers at Tufts University said in a recently published study. Healthy food prescriptions can provide a similar or bigger bang for your buck than many fancy drugs, devices, or surgeries, co-author Dariush Muzaffarian said via email. The plan wouldn't come cheap. Study authors estimate it would cost $122.6 billion over beneficiaries' lifetimes, but they also estimate it would eliminate the need to spend $39.7 billion on conventional health care measures over that period, and over time it might be more cost-effective than conventional treatments. So, we've now run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure and listen next time. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, formerly known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you've got any comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. Just give us a call at 919-832-5138.